Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. I'm Len, and you guys are probably all wondering what's going on. Where's Joey? Why isn't he here? Well, he's in sunny Jamaica, recharging his batteries where everything is Ari, but I'm not here alone. As you can tell, if you're watching on YouTube, I am with SB from the Woke Antidote podcast. SB, how are you, man?
What is going on? I'm so happy you asked me here to pinch hit for Joey. You know, he's off enjoying himself, but he lets us have a great opportunity to chat about a lot of fun stuff today.
I thought you would still be throwing darts at the Aaron Judge poster or the dartboard, considering that he re-signed with the Yankees and you being a Red Sox fan. Maybe you give some 2 cents into this. So what's your play in that re-signing?
You know, it's tough out there for a Red Sox fan because we used to be the team that was competing with all these big free agents and trying to get them and win a lot of them. But team hasn't been that good recently. We've let a lot of good guys go. And so, you know, but as a baseball fan, I do respect the history of the pinstripes. It's fun to have someone be on one team their whole career. So, you know, as much as I dislike the Yankees, I do respect it and respect them for re-signing Judge.
Well, gone are the days of you watching Big Poppy, Pedro, Manny, and you name it. You guys had a hell of a team when you won in the mid-2000s, and that was the one that broke the streak, the Curse of the Bambino. So hopefully you enjoyed it because there hasn't been too many since, right?
Well, there's been a few since, but I would say also the Sox fans, there's a Sox fan before 2004 and a Sox fan after, because the identity of the Red Sox fan, and the Cubs probably experienced this too, was you are the lovable losers. That was part of who you were as the sports fan. You didn't win anything. And it's different now that the Sox have won a decent amount. Same thing with the Patriots and the Celtics. So the Boston fan psyche has had to go through a change over the years.
Well, Bill Buckner has been forgiven, I guess, given what has transpired in the past 15 years at Red Sox territory. But with that being said, let's dive into what's going on in the markets, because that's what people are tuning into this show, and they want to hear what's going on with that in Bitcoin. And I know this probably doesn't really impact you too much, but Canada did raise the rates this past week or last week. It was 50 basis points, and that rate rose our rates to 4.25%. And I don't know, could this be the litmus test for the Federal Reserve when they make their decision on the 13th or 14th? And I just wanted to lay the table here like Ricky Henderson does. Starting off in 2022, the Federal Reserve, their rates were at 0.8%. And right now they're sitting at 3.78%. And that's all stats thanks to the New York Fed. And according to LendMath, 0.8% to 3.78%, that's a 470% increase. And that's happened in a span of less than 12 months. And with more to come in 2022. And of course, businesses and individuals, they're struggling now with this massive shift in both, cheap credit that was available for the past 20 years, and it's no longer available now. And with the words that we're hearing coming out of Jerome Powell's mouth, it appears there may be a rate coming up this month, next week, probably not 75 basis points, but we'll see what happens. But also there'll be some more rate hikes from what I gather in 2023. And because why are they doing that? Looks the there's a lot of rising costs. They're trying to rein that in. And this is the knee-jerk reaction from the Fed. And that's why we're here. We could try to analyze their decisions or their indecisions. But also something that's concerning is the yield curve. And I want to talk about this a little more in the show. And this past week, the two-year treasury yield traded at 4.2%. And the 10-year stood at 3.4%. This is from earlier this week. You might have some more up-to-date information than what I have here. And using that information, the difference between the two was 0.84%. And the yield curve remains inverted, and it's been here for quite some time. So next week, we're going to have a 50% basis points increase, or is this baked in the market? I want to hear your thoughts on this upcoming rate hike.
Yeah, so you set the table with a lot there. I love it. High on base percentage, always like Ricky Henderson did. So I'll try to jive you in here. I would say that there's a couple things. First is the fact that we're so inverted, 80 basis points, that's just it's a relic of this fiat era we're in, where if you take a step back and think about what the return should be for taking risk over the years, you should be getting paid more and more the longer you go out. And that's historically why you have a yield curve, and that's historically how the yield curve always is. The reason that it gets inverted is because that's a signal that the Fed is raising short-term rates too high and long-term rates are acting like growth is not going to be as high as what the Fed thinks, or we could be signaling a recession. And so that's why when you hear, oh, these twos, tens invert, or now the 2 year and the 30 year is inverting, a recession's coming soon, that's saying the Fed's making an error. They're raising rates way too much. And so that means that we're going to have a recession soon. So I think that's one part of it. The other piece you mentioned, we're going to have the 50 most likely. Yeah. So I'm looking at, I do have a Bloomberg terminal.
Flexing your muscles here.
It's important to the show because there's a lot of great information out there on these terminals, even though I don't necessarily like to refer to myself as a fiat bro that has one of these. But the information that the terminal has, they have something called WIRP, World Interest Rate Probability. And so that takes in what the bond market yield curve is and deduces what people think are going to happen, what the bond market's telling the market for rate hikes. And so what they're saying is the 50 is pretty much locked in. So if there's no yield movement over the next few days, we will get a 50 for next meeting. It's between a 25 and a 50 for the February meeting, which is the next one after that. It should be a 50 for the March 23 meeting. And then where it gets really interesting is we're looking at rates actually being cut, at least according to the current bond market, as soon as the summer of 2023. And then if we get to the end of December 2023 and early 2024, that's when there's multiple rate hikes being priced in based on these curves. And so I think what that tells you is what the general market consensus is also saying, that basically Wall Street and the investors were expecting a second half 2023 recession. And so if that's the case, then you would be, if you're the Fed, cutting rates in mid-2023 to start in order to try to stimulate the economy. And so that's why if you're raising rates aggressively now, the front end of the curve has to respond to the rate hikes. The long end of the curve says, do your rate hikes in the front end, but we're probably going to be in a recession sooner or later. And so we're just going to hang out down here. And that's how you're seeing that the inversion's 80 basis points are growing.
Is there any chance that they could fix this in the short term, or is this something that just has to work its course and there's really not much we can do? It's just basically it has to run its own course through its own momentum.
Well, I think the fix would be an immediate rate cut, right? Because then you would get the curve back to the equilibrium. But obviously we know that's not going to happen, because the whole Fed mantra right now is we're raising rates to attack inflation. So there's no way we're going to get a cut. On the other hand, you could look at it and say what the Fed's doing is they're supplying ammo so that when we do get a recession, they can immediately cut rates pretty substantially, and that's going to help things. I think the problem here, of course, is that if the Fed is hiking rates this aggressively, they're the ones causing the recession. And so then they're basically making the patient sick so that eventually they can try to cure them with a different policy, with the opposite policy than they're doing today. And so it's just kind of more fiat nonsense that I think us Bitcoiners, we look at and say, this should not be the system that we're currently running here.
It's incredible that so much power lies in the hands of so few people. I'm looking at the people at the Federal Reserve. And one thing that I'm wondering over there is they're going to continually raise rates, as you mentioned, it looks like, for the next several months. And is this with the intention they're going to do so, and with it, they're crossing their fingers that something doesn't break? Because I'm looking at everything seems to be breaking around us. And just today I saw a news story that there's a gas station in Philadelphia, for example, they're posting people, guards, armed guards over there with AR-15s, I think it was, because they have so much theft going on in that neck of the woods. So I'm looking at stories like that. And you look at a lot of people pilfering the Amazon trains that are coming in from the West Coast. It looks like the system is already broken. So how much more could they raise and still keep the people without really rioting? It seems like we're coming to a point where people are just, they had enough. So is raising rates, is this really the end, because they can't do any more? And they after that, they raise a couple of rates a couple of times. That's it, because they just can't break it any further?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right question. And it's the right answer that you're implying here, because the market is saying that you're not going to be able to raise rates that much longer. You're already quote unquote easing because you're taking the foot off the gas from the 75 basis point hikes, and now they're doing 50. And then in a couple meetings, it's probably going to be 25. So that's part of it. But yeah, I mean, if you look at where inflation is, I think the latest, you know, call it 7 to 8%, right? So you could argue that, and a lot of people do, that basically rates should be where the inflation rate is. And so if that's the case, then the rate should be a lot higher. Yes. People could also argue that, you know, if there isn't necessarily a one-to-one correlation, what rates should be doing is they should keep on raising rates until inflation gets at maybe to 2%, but at least closer to 2%. And from what we're seeing right now, that's not going to be the case. The bond market's not saying that they're going to be able to do that. They're only going to be able to do incrementally 50 or 25 from here. So I think you're exactly right. Things are starting to break a little bit. But then I also think, you know, I'm looking at this bond market movement, and I do think the bond market's starting to price in the recession, because the market participants are looking around and saying, you know, the economy is not looking so great, and we haven't really had too much of the effects of the 75 basis point hikes. That's a lag, and Chairman Powell said there's a lag there. And so if that's going to be the case, then yeah, let's let them hike a couple more times. But we're the long end of the bond market is sort of saying we're calling a recession in the second half of 2023, and that's what we think is going to happen.
This is now I'm coming out of left field here, so please correct me if I'm wrong. The fact that the federal government, they're running, I think the deficits are now over $1 trillion annually. So there's definitely a spending problem, not enough taxation dollars coming in as well. I mean, there's a number of different ways you could look at it. We could argue it till, I guess, we're blue in the face, but there's not enough money coming in. That's the reality. And they go out and they're borrowing. And really, the borrowing, it's creating, there is more money going into the system as they're doing this whole process. Now, can the Federal Reserve step in and say, no, we don't want to add any more liquidity to the market? We've done so. We've done enough in the past 3 years. Heck, we've done enough in the past 100 years. If they're trying, if they have the ability to stop more money going in the system, and if they really want to have the US dollar retain its value, can they do that? Do they have that within their power to say no more money is going to go out? You guys got to figure out with what you have?
Well, they could try to do that, but then if things break, as we were talking about, then they're in a much worse trouble. And one of the things that I've been arguing and debating with the people is I do think the Fed, at least for their own credibility, but also just generally they kept rates so low for so long, I think they're going to try to keep rates at like at least 4% for a little bit. So because to attempt to maintain credibility, what they might claim is that, all right, we got rates to 4.5%. Let's leave it there for at least a couple meetings, but ideally several months. And then from there, we can either go in either direction, depending on how the economy is looking and how inflation's going. So if you're the Fed, you know, rather than progressively do the 25 basis point hikes to where then you would have to immediately cut if things are going poorly, they preloaded the 75 basis point hikes so they can try to have those maybe 4 to 6 months in 2023 where they're keeping the rates the same. And then they'll have the ability to aggressively cut when the economy is not doing that well next year. So I kind of think the Fed, and it's funny because I think for people like me and you and Joey, I mean, you guys do a great job of talking about this nonsense that we see just every day from these Fed speakers and all that. But there's still people out there that really believe in the Fed, and it's otherwise intelligent people that, you know, I interact with on a daily basis for my job, that they really think the Fed can pretty much solve things. And so when the economy does poorly and when inflation is too high, it was a Fed error and the Fed can correct that error. And so, of course, I think that's total nonsense. I think the Fed's the one creating these problems and they cannot solve them because they have limited tools that they use in pretty poor ways. So yeah, so it speaks to what we think the Fed has no credibility, but there's still people out there that do. And so they're going to position themselves for those fiat bros essentially that still believe in them.
They're all Keynesians, every one of them that believe in it. And I think they're also looking at the page book, which was played back in the early 80s with Volcker. But really, at the time, it's harder to compare what's going on now with back then, because our debt to GDP is way higher. I think we're now at 125, 130% versus at that time it was around 30%. So really raising rates, it does help in one end now, but it's hurting in the other end, because now any newly created debt is going to be more costly. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on the debt to GDP ratio. Is this something that is going to be able to be controlled moving forward, or is this just a runaway freight train that just going to be running away for next, well, forever?
Yeah, so we're totally awash in debt. And I remember this, maybe it was high school when I had this realization, but when I first realized that the U.S. government, we don't actually ever repay any of the debt we take out. And it's sort of like this concept that when you're a kid, certainly you're thinking, all right, if I borrow money, I borrow $10 from my parents to buy a couple packs of baseball cards, then I've got to repay that over time. And I got to find the cash and the earnings to be able to do that. But the problem with the general, these big economies is that, yeah, we're never actually repaying this debt. We just want to have a decent enough debt to GDP ratio. And so it's kind of similar to companies in that way, where there's a lot of companies out there that continuously take on crazy amounts of debt. They don't have the cash flows to repay them, but they just want to grow their earnings so their ratios are reasonable. And I think you've hit it with the U.S. government. We're having these trillion-dollar deficits. We're never going to be able to get control of our debt in terms of the actual number. So to your point, it's going to be the debt to GDP, but it's high right now. So if we're going to continue on being this advanced nation with the world reserve currency, probably can't get that GDP to debt ratio or debt to GDP ratio that much higher. And so, yeah, maybe you do have that kind of soft default, I think is what it's called, where you take down that GDP to debt ratio via inflation. And maybe that's part of what we're seeing now. But in terms of whether it's sustainable, I don't think it is, because if you are trying to use inflation to get out of this, well, then you're going to have a potential for societal collapse, because we all see in our daily lives, 7% inflation, 8% inflation, it's more like 20-25% for a lot of the goods we really need. It's probably more than that in a lot of areas too. And we're going to be on hard times for a lot of people when there's a couple years of that we have to experience. So yeah, I just think in general, you know, what is the last fiat cycle? You know, I think people have been talking about this for a while. I think on Bitcoin Twitter, you know, I see people saying like, oh, you know, the gold bugs, they've been calling the end of the fiat cycle, you know, several times. And so I kind of like, I don't hate that, because a lot of the stuff you look at and say, it is kind of a confidence game. And if the confidence falls one time, we might not be able to get it back and the system collapses. I don't know when that's going to happen, but, you know, could it happen before we know it and before a lot of people predict it? I think absolutely.
It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when, unfortunately. And you touched upon debt, companies taking on debt. And I think that's a good segue to our next topic. And we could talk about Elon Musk. And let me know if I got this wrong, because I did some research today with respect to this. And Twitter was purchased by Elon Musk for $44 billion. And through this purchase, Twitter took on, from what I understand, $13 billion of debt, of which $3 billion, this all with a B, by the way, not with an M, B, billion. They took on that $3 billion is of high interest rate and reportedly at around 11.75%. That's incredibly high for that amount of money. But you know what? I guess he didn't have many options at that time. And it looks like the bankers are considering to give him new margin loans that will be backed by Tesla equity. Very interesting. And a new loan would be coming with a lower rate to replace the existing loan. So do I have this right? And I want to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, so I love talking about this. And we were talking before the show about wanting to touch on this, because I think what Elon's done with Twitter is a perfect example of how there's too much debt in the system. And so if you think about what Elon did, he did sell a lot of Tesla shares in order to equity finance a lot of the Twitter purchase, for sure. And so that's different than what a lot of private equity companies usually do, which is they load companies up with 80-90% of the purchase price in debt that's on the company's balance sheet. So Elon didn't do 80-90%, but yeah, he did a significant amount of debt on Twitter's balance sheet. And, you know, that might have been okay in this ZERP environment, zero interest rate policy environment. It's a lot tougher nowadays because now it's about the free cash flow instead of crazy user growth at any expense. You know, I've seen in my space where I've seen companies that issued high yield bonds at, you know, low 3% coupon rates in summer of 2021, let's call it, when we were still having pandemic benefits and interest rates were still zero. And that's those same companies that issued at 3%. Now their bonds are 8 or 9%. So if they went out to the market and tried to refinance some of their debt, they'd have to pay a good, you know, 6% more. So if you think about Twitter, you know, you've got a highly indebted company here because they don't produce that much in terms of earnings. So what Elon's going to have to grapple with is he needs to significantly cut the costs of Twitter for a couple reasons. One, to get the ratios in line, because, you know, the equivalent of the debt to GDP ratio for country is typically EBITDA, which is, you know, a proxy for earnings over or it's debt to EBITDA. So it's how much debt you have relative to your earnings. And that's completely out of whack now. So Elon's got to get his earnings way up. And then Elon's also got to get Twitter producing free cash flow to be able to pay the new interest rate on the debt, which is going to be significant. So that's kind of a microcosm of what we're seeing across the entire space right now. Elon's attacking it by aggressively cutting costs, trying to get new revenue sources, but I'm not sure how effective those are going to be so soon. But, you know, if you can cut 75% of your costs, you're going to improve your earnings for sure. So that's going to be positive. But, you know, and thinking a little bit about private equity in general, you know, this is a huge symptom of the fiat system that, you know, I completely despise. And I think if any Bitcoiners are listening and they're not totally aware, I kind of want to touch on it briefly, because what happens is these private equity companies, you know, they will buy, you know, whether it was Twitter or Elon's case, but they'll buy companies that maybe the company's worth, let's call it $10 billion. And they might buy the company for $12.5 billion. So they have a 25% premium. And that's the reason that the owners of the company currently are going to sell, because they want a nice pop on their company, and they get paid out, and the CEOs often get these golden parachutes. But what the private equity company will do is, if the company is worth $10 billion and they paid $12.5 billion for it, they might load $10 billion of debt onto the company's balance sheet to finance the purchase. And then the rest, $2.5 billion, the private equity can put in terms of equity. And so where private equity wins in this scenario is that then they drastically cut costs, they improve earnings, their equity becomes worth more in the short term. But then long term, they've set this company up pretty much for failure, because they've not only, you know, completely demolished their employee base and their R&D and kind of in their CapEx, everything, but they've also saddled them with this huge amount of debt with high interest rates. And this is destroying companies across the US, across the world. And the problem is going to be, if you're one of these companies that got taken over by private equity over the past 5 years, and you did it during the zero interest rate environment policy, well, then when you go and try to refinance that debt in 2023, 2024, all of a sudden that debt you raised at 4 or 5%, it's going to be 12%, or you're not going to be able to raise it and you're going to go bankrupt. So, you know, to wrap it up, what it means is that there's so much debt that's weighing down like everything in this economy. And, you know, it's not like it would happen overnight, but we got to get out of this debt monstrosity somehow. And I think a big way to do that is something like Bitcoin, which is going to encourage people actually saving in Bitcoin, not taking out debt, and trying not to get, trying not to get 2% on government bonds over 30 years when your currency that you're saving in is appreciating much more than that.
It's difficult for people to adjust to the Bitcoin mentality. Is everybody has a credit card in their pocket, and everybody has the ability to get some sort of loan. And they're not spending for today. They're spending on the income they have coming in tomorrow. And it's such a fiat mentality, not just the way you've outlined what's going on with companies just getting wrecked, but also just the way people in general operate. And it also reminds me a little bit of the election cycle. Everything is just about for the next 4 years, 2 years, whatever it is. There's no long-term thinking. And, you know, and with respect to the interest rates that are creeping up and it's impacting companies to try to raise money moving forward, over here in Canada, it's really impactful for homeowners because we generally have 5-year mortgage cycles. People don't lock in for much longer than that. Some people do, but for the majority, it's 5 years. And the ones that locked in 5 years ago at very, very low rates now are going to be coming into in a market where everything is going to be much more costly when they renew the mortgage, and it's going to be really problematic for them. But to go back to Twitter, I think they have an excellent opportunity to raise a heck of a lot of, or to gain a lot of revenue moving forward. That $8 a month charge that they're going to be offering to people to get that little check mark besides them, what people like to have, that's low hanging fruit. It doesn't cost a lot of money, at least for people living in Western societies. And there's a lot of people out there that I think they're going to want to get that. I took a look at Twitter's numbers. They have around 450 million users. Now, I'm not going to say that the majority or even close to even half of them would get this. But if they can snag, say, 10 million, 15, 20 million, well, times that by $8 a month, that's going to be a new stream of revenue they never had before. Even though they had a lot of these companies out there decided to cut bait and no longer promote on Twitter, he found a way to offset that and maybe make a heck of a lot more. What do you think about that? Is this just something they had under their noses all this time and they just didn't see it? Because it seems like it's a lot of money they could just make like that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be big. I'm of the belief that some of these corporate companies that have tens of millions of followers, those are incredibly valuable to those companies, not only for their own promotion and marketing and getting people to buy their products, but also for their brand. I mean, they can send out a tweet and all of a sudden, hey, that's funny. You know, there's a lot of brands out there that use Twitter pretty effectively in cultivating a certain image to send out to their potential customers. So I think that for some of these big enterprises, forget $8. Let's charge them millions just for those companies in general to be on the platform. So I like that. And then I also think, so, you know, it's funny if you listen and you see the headlines about Facebook, now Meta, you see Google, and then now you see Amazon as well. I saw a headline that Amazon today is looking to do a TikTok-esque feed to promote people buying on their platform.
Wow.
Yeah. And so you've got Facebook doing Reels and you've got YouTube doing Shorts to compete with TikTok. So TikTok clearly is this, there's this product fit for it. The Gen Zs, you know, people younger than us, they love this stuff. And certainly, you know, I've been on TikTok before. I don't have it now, but it's incredibly addicting with one video after another. And so if you're Elon, get some of that TikTok business and have better creator payouts. And this is what Facebook's doing and what Google's doing to try to get people on their platforms. But, you know, if you're using a Twitter account to promote other platforms you're on, why not just do your creations inside of Twitter? And so Elon's been mentioning that on, you know, probably a lot of his tweets and replying to people. But I think the creator economy living on Twitter instead of the creator economy only using Twitter as a marketing platform, I think that shift could be very interesting.
Well, TikTok seems to be enemy number one when it comes to politicians, because there seems to be the narrative that it is a way of harvesting data from the users and send it over to, well, the mothership in China. And so if they could find another way to track those users, I think regulators here and politicians would absolutely love that, considering that Elon Musk is, for the most part, I know he's born in Africa and spent a lot of time in Canada. He's an American right now from the way I kind of view him. So with that being said, I think that would be an excellent idea for them for monetizing their platform. And the fact that Amazon's moving into this, I didn't hear about that. That's just amazing. But to go back to Twitter, one thing that really is concerning for me as a Bitcoiner is Elon's affinity to Doge. And for whatever reason, I have a sneaky suspicion he's going to try to shoehorn that into the Twitter world and not have Bitcoin instituted in the way it should be, because I don't know what it is with Doge. He loves it. But for whatever reason, he's going to be using it and trying to pump it. Maybe he's just trying to pump his bags as much as possible. And I guess that's what a good businessman does. But Bitcoin's right there. Why not, instead of using or promoting Doge, let's do the same for Bitcoin. He still owns Bitcoin on his personal balance sheet. So what's going on over there?
Yeah, I think with Elon, you know, he's got an ego, you know, as everybody does. But I think the guys that make it big, they have just massive egos, because they wouldn't have made it big like that. They have a certain drive. And so I think what he sees in Doge is he gets a kick out of when he talks about it, Doge moves. I mean, and certainly it moves more when he talks about Doge than Bitcoin moves when he does something with it. So I kind of think that's what he gets. That's the benefit. But I would like to think he realizes that it's a complete joke. And, you know, let's be real. Tesla doesn't have any Doge on its balance sheet. It has Bitcoin on it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of, you know, where's, you know, put your money where your mouth is. And granted, like, he's not the only decision maker at Tesla, but that's also something to look at, where Elon clearly wants Tesla to be worth a lot of money, because he still has a large share in there and he wants the company to be successful. So he doesn't want to lose money on Doge. So I think that's kind of where his true thoughts lie. But to your point about him using Bitcoin or crypto, so I was listening to the space that he did this past weekend, where he just kind of hopped on randomly. I think he was on a, you know, private jet, talking for 2 hours with I think some Bitcoiners on a Twitter, maybe Kim.com was on there as well. And, you know, he did, someone asked him about using Bitcoin and the Lightning Network on Twitter. And he responded that, yes, he does think that crypto provides an alternative to fiat currency, and that he sees crypto potentially being of use in payments. So he didn't specify Bitcoin. He didn't specify Lightning. But I would like to think that the guy is incredibly smart. We know this, whether you like him or not. You can't diminish the business success he's had. And if he's truly the great businessman and investor and just kind of the inventor that we think he is, and what he's shown, he'll find his way to Bitcoin and the Lightning Network sooner or later. So maybe that's hopeful. I don't know. You know, I think you can look at some of the tweets that we had up on the Woke Antidote Twitter account, where we were telling people, hey, like, before, we were telling people that, you know, they were getting mad about Elon not immediately doing everything that they wanted him to do on Twitter. Like, oh, you're not immediately putting Trump back. You're not pro free speech. And we said, and me and TB and we talked, we said, just wait, give him some time. He's got to get into Twitter, understand the team he works with, get his people. And I think we're already seeing huge benefits from what he's done already. So give him some time. Bitcoin and Lightning probably isn't the first priority. He needs to figure out a lot of things at Twitter first, but certainly in the long run, I can absolutely see this being a huge boon for Twitter and Bitcoin over time.
I think also with his affiliation with Jack Dorsey, and Jack Dorsey has been a very good Bitcoiner, he's trying to promote it as much as possible. I think that's going to be in Bitcoin's favor as well. But I do think that he is a little, Elon Musk is a little bit of a troll with his Doge pumping. But let's change gears here. And I want to talk a little bit about MicroStrategy. And if anybody hasn't heard him, he was just on Patrick Bet David's show. I don't mean to pump other podcasts besides the Woke Antidote podcast, but check him out on that Patrick Bet David show, because that was absolutely dynamite. So with respect to Michael Saylor, love him or hate him, he's not one, if not the biggest link for Bitcoin to Wall Street. So like, that's the way I look at him. And he has a huge amount of skin in the game, not just his business, but personally, he does as well. From what I was gathering today, I was my notes here, his company, MicroStrategy, or at least a company he used to lead in the past, he's no longer the CEO, they have around 130,000 Bitcoin. That's a heck of a lot of Bitcoin on their balance sheet. And Michael Saylor by himself, too, has around 17,000 Bitcoin. That's a heck of a lot, too. To give you an idea how much that's worth, 17,000 Bitcoin at $17,000 per Bitcoin, or the block clock just changed, that's around $289 million. And to consider how far this went, back when it was $69,000, that same Bitcoin was worth $1.173 billion. So that's quite a drop from $1.173 billion to $289 million. He's not crying poor, but he still lost a lot of money, at least potential value, given the price drop in Bitcoin. But some will argue that with respect to Michael Saylor, he is the most to gain and the most to lose given his position right now. And MicroStrategy, they took a lot of debt or some debt to buy Bitcoin. And we talked about any newly issued debt that's going to be issued is going to be more costly due to what's going on with the Federal Reserve. MicroStrategy, if the worst comes to worst, and if they were to dump their Bitcoin on the market, this would be catastrophic to the price of Bitcoin, no doubt. It wouldn't be as bad as GBTC dropping, doing the same thing, but it would definitely be in the same league. Not in the same ballpark, definitely the same league. What are your thoughts on MicroStrategy, and should Bitcoiners be concerned about a potential dump on the Bitcoin of their Bitcoin that they just released because of whatever hits them?
So really glad we're talking about this because I see this so much on Bitcoin Twitter, and really not even only that on FinTwit or financial Twitter, where you've got a lot of these fiat bros working in traditional finance, you know, trying to opine on MicroStrategy and Coinbase to that effect too. So to answer your question, are we in imminent danger of MicroStrategy dumping Bitcoin? Strongly believe absolutely not. We aren't. Hmm. But the broad point is this. So what Saylor has done is he's bought a lot of Bitcoin for a lot higher of a price than the Bitcoin is now. And so you kind of have to think about that and go, at a certain point, that differential, if it remains, has to affect his business and the price of his securities in some way. Because if you're out there taking out debt and buying Bitcoin at 40, 50, 60K, and now it's worth a third of that, well, then what happens when you have to repay that debt? And so that's really what people have to think about. And what I'll do with MicroStrategy, let's leave aside the loan they have with, I think, Silvergate, because there's so much collateral that they could put into that loan. I think it's Bitcoin would have to drop to something like 3,000, they've said. So that's not realistic. And then the other one, he has debt that is secured by the software company as well as Bitcoin he bought with that offering. Let's leave aside that. The two that I want to focus on are convertible notes that he issued. And generally in finance, what you want to do with convertible notes is you issue them, but you ideally want to either refinance into another convertible or pay off with issued equity shares. You really would prefer not to have to repay that in cash. And the reason you'd have to repay it in cash is that if the stock is so much lower than when you issued the converts, and so no one who's holding that actually wants to convert to your equity because they'd lose a lot of money. And so if I'm looking at the price of MicroStrategy's convertible bonds right now, you've got a 0.75% one due in December 2025 that's trading at 60 cents on the dollar. And then you've got a zero coupon February 2027 bond, $1.1 billion of that, $38 price. So you look at that and you go, all right, you know, it's MicroStrategy equity. I think that the highest it was at was 1400. It's at 200 now. Clearly MicroStrategy is very much in tune with the Bitcoin price. If we zoom back to, you know, 50K, if Bitcoin does what it typically does during a halving, then we're fine. MicroStrategy is probably fine because it's going to be able to refinance that debt either with new convertible notes or the equity is just going to be so much higher. They can issue a bunch of equity to repay those. So that's not going to be an issue. The issue for them is going to be if Bitcoin stays in this range and then all of a sudden there's $1.7 billion of debt out there in convertible notes that they're going to have to repay somehow, or, you know, maybe do a distressed exchange for it, something like that. And their software company, while successful, is not generating nearly enough money to go out and make $1.7 billion in a couple of years. There's no chance. So the long answer to your question is that certainly right now, I don't see any risk of them selling it. The risk would be if we're in that kind of like mid-2024 timeframe and the halving's coming up or it's here and it happened and the Bitcoin price hasn't really moved or it's gone down from what it is today, that's when it starts to get a little dicey, and there's going to have to be thoughts of what are the additional financing options the MicroStrategy can do to repay the debt they've taken out to buy the Bitcoin originally. So yeah, so near term, definitely not worried about it. But I would say, look, too, if Bitcoin's at 17K at the end of 2024, you know, yeah, it's not going to be great if MicroStrategy has to sell some of that. But I would say I'd be pretty disappointed in that personally as a Bitcoiner if it's that low after a halving, after probably rate cuts in the latter half of 23 or 2024. So that would be highly disappointing before any potential forced sale that MicroStrategy would take on.
It would be a great stocking opportunity if that ever plays out. But with respect to MicroStrategy, they pretty much stopped buying Bitcoin. I don't recall the last time they added any more Bitcoin to their balance sheet. Do you think, or do you foresee them adding or buying any more Bitcoin in the foreseeable future? Or is this something that you're just going to, an idea that's going to be shelved, and you're just going to try dealing with the debt that they've accumulated for purchasing the Bitcoin that they have at this moment?
Yeah, I think that the benefit to MicroStrategy, I mean, yes, there's a lot of principal amount of debt outstanding, but they took on very low coupons because they did it in that convertible type of note. And so, you know, it's 0.75% interest rates on all that debt. I would say for purchasing it in the future, they do have an equity program right now that they can issue equity to basically do anything they want to with it. They haven't used that yet, but they have used that in the past to buy Bitcoin. I think certainly with the stock at 200, you have to weigh, you know, what credit am I getting for the Bitcoin with at the stock at that price? Does it make sense to buy more down here? The other way they could do it is simply with the cash flow generated from the business. And they've done this a few times, I think, in $10 million increments. So if I had to guess, I wouldn't be surprised to see a $5 or $10 million Bitcoin buy from them sometime soon. But in terms of those big chunks, that to me is a little bit tougher. And especially because they have that $500 million equity program out there, but it doesn't seem like they've used it, or if they have used it, it has not been for Bitcoin. And I would think that if Bitcoin is the price it is now, probably pretty attractive to buy. And so you probably would have used some of that for Bitcoin now. So if they haven't used it for Bitcoin to date, I don't really foresee it in the future. So yeah, for me, it's more of that smaller incremental buy would make more sense to me.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but El Salvador is trying to purchase, I believe, one Bitcoin per day. Relatively small in the grand scheme of things, but they don't have a large budget to deal with. So maybe that's the model that MicroStrategy should be adopting, is buying something along those lines, maybe a partial Bitcoin over a day to try to DCA what they already have on their balance sheet. But with that, I think we should wrap things up. And before we close things off here, I just want to thank you for coming on the show and just hand it off to you. Where can people find you and what are you doing these days?
Yeah. So yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on. This is a blast. Yeah. For where people can find me on Twitter, at the Woke Antidote, it's in there. So I'm SB Stonks Bro. We got a TB Tech Bro as well doing, we haven't done the pod as much as we like, but we're hoping to get back and rolling, but we have a nice archive there, and it's a fun time just kind of thinking about a lot of the craziness going on in America, and you guys see plenty of it in Canada too. But yeah, beyond that, I mean, you know, look, we chat a lot ourselves, but there's so much going on in the finance world these days, in the investment world. And you know, as I've said to you guys, you know, I talk to people that have been in this game for decades, and they're saying that the bond market volatility, and specifically the treasury market volatility, it is the most intense they have ever seen in their career. And they've been doing this since the 80s, 90s. So I think that really speaks to, you know, it's hard for us to maybe understand this if you haven't been in finance that much, or, you know, if you're a Bitcoiner, you don't have a huge knowledge of it. We're in some bizarre times. I would say we're in some unprecedented times. I mean, even as we talked about at the start of the show, the 80 basis point differential in terms of the yield curve inversion, I think the last time we saw that might have been the 2000s telecom bubble, tech bubble. So this stuff doesn't happen that often. It's why it's really fascinating to talk about. But I do think that as Bitcoiners, you know, we've been through so much negative in the macro in over the past 6 months. Definitely could see more, not saying we couldn't, but for those that have the conviction, would really like to think that there's just a really nice, you know, pot of gold, I guess, to call it, at the end of the rainbow here, and we'll be able to see that. So I would say that you guys do a great job of talking about your conviction, even though, you know, Joey is a little bearish all the time. I do have to give some credit, though. I have to give Joey some credit about calling, you know, the teens on Bitcoin. But you know what? He did have to get bailed out by SBF on that one. So I think without FTX and that FTT shenanigans, we probably wouldn't be here right now.
But you know what? It doesn't matter how he got there. It's he got there, and there could be some more coming. Who knows? SBF may not be FTX may not be the last large company that capitulates during these hard and troubling times. So who knows? 17K might seem like a very high price, but what may come out in the next few days or next few weeks? Who the hell knows? But I'm not going to make any predictions because I'm generally wrong. I just want to say that somebody gave some kudos here, saying great addition for the co-host to replace Joey. So yeah, people seem to love your appearance here, and yeah, so you're welcome anytime to come back on the show. So thank you very much for showing up, and everybody that was in the chat, appreciate your contribution to the show. And we'll be back on Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern. So join in. It's going to be another awesome episode. So with that, take care and have a wonderful evening.